you want to see Zoe Strauss's photographs, they are displayed on more than 50 billboards all over Philadelphia. You can also go to the Philadelphia Art Museum to view a new exhibition of her work, Zoe Strauss, 10 Years. She's a street photographer whose unflinching and humane portraits document the lives of ordinary people and those struggling with poverty and addiction. A decade ago, Zoe Strauss began displaying her photographs under I-95 and selling them for $5 a piece. Coming up, meet Zoe Strauss, but first, WHYY's arts reporter Peter Crimmins has this report.
Zoe Strauss blew up her photographs to enormous proportions to be installed as billboards. They're an extension of her 10-year retrospective at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, but they are not ads.
They're just photos. No text or logo. I want people to take a lot of questions away from the billboards and make their own narrative about it.
At the corner of Passyunk and Reed Streets, Frank Lynch is making his own narrative about it. He works at a nearby auto body shop, and he came out to watch news crews take pictures of a 300-square-foot image of an elderly lady while it was being installed on a billboard.
Because I was wondering why they had all these cameras on that billboard, because I lived directly back in the billboard. I lived directly back, and I thought my house was burning. My crib was burning or something.
Oh, thank God.
I seen all the cameras. Seriously.
Yeah.
Somebody said, Frank, they're putting cameras at your place upstairs. I'm like, what?
So I live at 13th and Dickinson, and this woman lives across the street from me, Antoinette Conti. It's just neighbors. It's just neighbors up on the billboard.
Okay.
And there's like a whole longer like thing.
It's that whole longer thing, Strauss mentioned, that makes these huge images an art installation. Because on the surface, the image is just Antoinette Conti. She's a 69-year-old woman who's been living in a row house at 13th and Dickinson for 49 years. She says Strauss explained it to her this way.
She said, you're South Philly. You're my idea of the neighborhood. Antoinette, I want to take your picture. I said, okay, Zoe, whatever you want is okay with me. Now, this is the thing. Your picture will be near the Acme. I said, okay, near the Acme. Okay, so whatever, you know. Lord knows, I thought it was going to be on a tree. You know how they nail the... We're having a yard sale or something? Not knowing it was going to be as big as Gibraltar, but that's Zoe.
Conti is a second-generation Italian-American. She lives next to a first-generation Mexican-American named Fernando Trebino. In 2 months, Antoinette's image will be replaced by Fernando's. Both images are called La Corona, which means the crown in both Italian and Spanish.
Yeah.
Strauss began her art career by taking pictures of her South Philadelphia neighborhood and posting them on concrete columns below I-95, where she sold them for $5 apiece. That was 10 years ago, and since then, her pictures have taken off, now commanding thousands of dollars in fine art galleries. The billboard images are portraits, and still lifes, and handwritten signs. They're not always easy to figure out.
They're up so that people will see them and make whatever narrative they want out of them. But for me, there's very distinct connections between each of them and many different reasons for why they're all kind of in place.
With these billboards, Strauss is telling a very abstract version of the Odyssey, the epic poem by Homer. But you'd never know that by just looking at them. She is bending pictures taken over the last 10 years into a story of struggle and homecoming. Near the 30th Street train station are two more billboards side by side. One shows a hand-painted sign Strauss discovered in a small town near the Gulf of Mexico that was recovering from the BP oil spill. It says, "Don't forget us." It's next to an image of dilapidated row homes in Philadelphia.
Those are the homes that were destroyed when the city bombed the move house in the 80s, and the houses were rebuilt substandardly and essentially forced out residents on the block twice. It's a very tragic story in Philadelphia, but one that really matters a great deal in terms of thinking about our city's history.
Many of the images on the billboards are not pretty. Some of them are downright strange.
I'm sure we're going to get a lot of calls, people wondering what actually is going on.
That's Gary Turner. He sells ad space for Clear Channel, which donated most of the billboards for this project.
I love the fact that Zoe didn't have copy on the boards, and I think if advertisers could think about that less is best, which is something that we strive to do with Out of Home, getting people to sort of interact with the medium and make it more of a personal message.
The images can be read politically. They can be read as photojournalism. But Strauss says she's aiming for a subjective, deeply personal narrative of people shaped by their particular environments. That's why she started hanging pictures under 95 in the first place.
This is a different kind of take and narrative, but it's still directly related to all of that work that was specific to the installation under 95. It's just migrating.
I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Zoe Strauss' 10 years is on view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and it runs through April 22nd. And Zoe Strauss joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And what a pleasure. Congratulations on your work, your exhibitions, the billboards. How are you dealing with all of this?
I am just not dealing.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. I'm just kind of bobbing on
over
the surface.
Here?
Yep. I'm just moving along. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a genuine pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you very much. And do you see a connection between the work that you started 10 years ago under I-95 and where you are today?
Yes, absolutely. The work that I worked on for I-95, which was from 2000 to 2010, that work is the basis for the exhibition. And it's primarily moving the work from the end of that was a complete piece, and then taking that work and making one final narrative of it that's both inside and outside the museum.
Do you miss the sounds of being under I-95? I think of those sounds.
Yeah, I do, actually. That kind of rhythmic pattern of hitting the joints, the joint separators of the traffic above. It was, yes, and that was very specific to the installation, the idea that you had to kind of get close to someone in order to talk to them in this massive, massive space because of how loud it was.
Now, you began taking photographs. You were about, 30 years old?
Yeah, I was 30.
Was there an aha moment or something that got you to pick up a camera?
Yeah, I thought about the installation. I kind of conceived the installation under I-95.
Even before you had a camera?
Right, before I had the camera. So the installation, the concept for the installation came first, and then the camera was second. The photographs were secondary to actually create the installation. So installation plan came first, and then the photographs were made actually for the installation.
So when you thought of the installation, did you have an image of the kinds of photographs that you wanted to put on the columns, for instance?
I'd say I spent about the first year trying to figure out which images would make sense. And I had kind of an idea that I wanted it to be portraiture and architectural and text-based. And I wanted those because I wanted to create this kind of movement I wanted to create a kind of choreography that happened, like a push and pull under the highway from one image to the next. And those three structures seem to make the most sense to move people in different directions.
So you got your camera. I believe people bought it for you, or you were able to save some money to buy a camera.
Yeah, my wife and my mother and siblings actually gave me money to buy the camera. So.
And what was your first camera?
It was...
Or maybe this is the camera you still have.
I know. I still have it, for
Do
sure.
You?
Oh, yeah. It's the Canon. It's a 35mm Canon Rebel, which was, Andre Agassi was really the guy who totally was kind of the spokesperson for it. So it was a great camera, but it was also kind of a populist camera as well.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
It was a camera that many people could actually afford to buy, and a camera that many people knew, and one that was accessible to people who were interested in photography, but even if it was not a standard household camera.
Now, I'm curious about your approach, and we heard a little bit in Peter's piece of Antoinette Conti, who's on a billboard in her neighborhood, and she said, this is one of your neighbors, and she said, Zoe asked to take my picture, and, that's Zoe. I'm going to do that. How do you approach, I'm interested in how you approach someone that you don't know, a stranger on the street. You see somebody. Mm-hmm. You see something. How do you go from there?
I always, if I'm approaching someone to make a portrait and not taking a photo that's either a crowd shot or one of someone striding by an architectural structure, I always ask. I approach with the camera out and I say, I'm interested in making your photo. And then I say this, I give the reason why. And then I say, what do you think? And we have a little, this is where the photograph might be seen. And it's changed over the years because it had always been, I'm working on this installation under I-95 and it might go nowhere or it might be there. And then as as my work moved into the world in a different way, I just would have an add-on. It might be in a book. I might show it in a gallery. And so it's just a discussion of where it could be.
And have you found, even looking back over your work, that there's certain things that you're interested in or certain looks that seem to speak to you?
I think there are. I generally try to keep everything pretty unconscious when I'm shooting,
it just feels right.
Yeah, just seems right in the moment, and there's always a real reason why I want to approach someone. There's something there is some kind of connection that I just go with. I immediately say, sometimes it's because I saw you looked like this, or sometimes it's because I saw you doing this, and sometimes it's because I don't know why. Mm. I just felt like I just saw you, and I wanted to make a portrait of you. I don't have a great answer for why.
And when you're taking someone's picture, are they posing? Are you telling them to do things? Are you moving with your camera? What are you asking of your subject?
They always choose the pose. So when I'm making a portrait, the person is always able to pose exactly as they choose it, always. And occasionally I'll say, do you mind stepping out of shadow into sun? Or, you know, it's the most basic of, or there's a pole behind your head. Do you mind moving a foot to the right? So it's always kind of a collaboration. It's always something that there's an exchange. And it's very direct. It's very short and it's very direct. And it's always the person has the ability to kind of move into whatever position they want. And now, with a digital camera, they see the images.
So you can actually show it
to
them.
So I show them the images immediately following.
We heard from Antoinette Conti, one of your neighbors. I mean, obviously, who would not love her?
No one.
I just heard, 15 seconds of her voice, and it's hard not to feel great affection for this woman. I'm also looking at one of the pictures in your book, A Woman in a Pink Shirt, Camden, New Jersey, 2006, and clearly a woman who has seen tough times.
Yeah, absolutely. She's a woman who I met her and another woman all at the same time. There's another image of her and another woman sitting together, and we were all strangers. We had all just met, and kind of in this one moment, these two women were walking to each other, and I was driving back to the Walt Whitman Bridge, and this woman's shirt is this kind of unbelievably vibrant pink, and that was what made me pull over, because it was in kind of a little bit of a gray stretch in Camden along Broadway. So I pulled over just on the basis of this shirt, which was really was spectacular in the landscape. And coming out of This Is Why I Stopped, then I made a number of portraits of them.
And we're almost up on a break here, but what I see, though, is a woman she's thin. Mm-hmm. I don't, all your photographs look like there's a story there. I don't know what her story is, but I don't think it's a happy one.
I think it's a mix. I think it's really, one of the things is that a number of the photographs in which there's often a difficult image, the exchange was very loving and open and thrilling. And sometimes some of the images that seem to have a happier moment are ones that actually have a more difficult story.
Interesting. I want to pick up on that after this very short break. Talking with the photographer Zoe Strauss. You can see her photographs on more than 50 billboards all over Philadelphia. Her work is also on view at an exhibition at the Art Museum of Philadelphia. It's called Zoe Strauss 10 Years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents Comic Catharsis, a gift of cartoons by William Steig. The creator of Shrek, Steig achieved fame for his thousands of cartoons, New Yorker magazine covers, and his humorous observations on human relationships. Comic Catharsis at the Brandywine River Museum is on view now through March 11th. Details online at brandywinemuseum.org.
Hello, I'm Christine Dempsey.
And I'm Ed Cunningham.
If you tune to WHYY more than 4 hours a week, then you're a loyal listener.
And since you are, you might be interested in our YStream service.
YStream is a thank you gift that gives you online access to programs without pledge breaks.
Make your donation to WHYY before Monday, and you can listen pledge-free on your iPad, iPhone, PC, or Mac.
Visit whyy.org/YStream for details.
The new film Red Tails is a fictionalized account of a story drawn from the history books, that of the first black pilots to serve in the U.S. military, the Tuskegee Airmen.
One of the things that a lot of people don't realize is just how rigid segregation was at that time. What we did helped to break those barriers.
We'll speak with an original Tuskegee Airman as well as one of the stars of Red Tails. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with photographer Zoe Strauss. She first began exhibiting her work underneath an elevated section of I-95. Now her work is being shown at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and on 50 billboards, or more than 50 billboards, all over the city. We're talking about how she approaches her work, which she has described as an epic narrative about the beauty and struggle of everyday life. We're also taking phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. One thing I love about photographs, and frankly love about your photographs as well, is it does feel as if there is a story. There is, I mean, I don't know what the story is. You don't tell us what the story is, but when I look at the pictures, I'm thinking, who are these people? Where did they come from? How did they end up here? Why are they wearing that shirt?
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad to hear it, because that's a major component of my work, is presenting the image for the viewer to complete the narrative mm-hmm. themselves. And that's kind of the crux of it, is being able to have the viewer construct and finish the image for themselves.
I wonder, though, and I'm looking at Woman in Pink Shirt, Camden, New Jersey, 2006, and clearly you approach your subjects with a great deal of dignity and humanity, but I could also see someone judging her. I mean, coming away with a narrative that might not be the true one.
Right, absolutely.
Is that the risk you take in a way?
Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely, I mean, there's a great imbalance of power that comes in street photography in general, which is the photographer is then the one who is essentially using a person's image, a real image of someone, and using it as a metaphor.
Right.
And using it, presenting it without, my images are presented, they're not photojournalism, they're presented without story or text, so that's a real risk. And it's one that I think about a lot, but it's one that I think is worth it in terms mm-hmm. of allowing the work to kind of move out into the world. And my hope is that people will be able to construct something that will actually cause more questions than a final answer for them.
Do you take inspiration from some of the Depression photographers? You know, I'm thinking about the Walker Evans and others who Dorothea Lange, that photographed during the Depression.
Yeah, absolutely. All the WPA photographers. I'm very, very interested in the history of photography on the whole. And I often like to reference some of those specific mm-hmm. photos, and especially during the course of working on I-95, it was very important to me to have these echoes and a direct homage to some of the images that I thought were so important in terms of moving photography forward, and how people actually began to see and read photography in a different way. So many of the images are ones that I actually have specifically shot to reference those and pay homage to.
What I also found interesting, there are a lot of streetscapes, I would say. I mean, corner stores with signs. I mean, a very urban landscape. You also have more sort of rural pictures as well. Mm-hmm. But the urban landscape is vibrant and exciting.
Yeah, I think that the urban landscape, because of where I'm from, and that's what the work began, really very close to my house, and then moved into all different places. But it was it really began kind of in a place where that urban landscape is genuinely vibrant and moving, and often has a kind of constant a juxtaposition of difficulty and joy in our lives.
There are a couple of photographs of people that are naked or near naked. Is it hard mm-hmm. to get people to take their clothes off?
No, not even remotely.
Not even remotely.
Yeah, how about that? Not even close to hard. Yeah, sometimes.
And this is in people's houses. It looks like you're in someone's house.
Yes, a couple, a few of the photographs, and there's one specific of a man who's kind of laying on his bed, and yes. he's in this odalisque pose, and it's very, for me, it's very, very tender and beautiful, this kind of image. And it was probably a 10-minute interaction total of me stopping him and saying, "Can I?" I saw him standing on the stairs at his apartment building, and was, "May I make your photo? I see you standing here." And his posture was—he was really standing upright. It was the kind of thing that made me stop, and standing upright with arms akimbo. And so I pulled right over and was like, "May I make your photo?" And within 10 minutes, full session in his upstairs apartment.
And you're upstairs in his apartment.
Yeah, it was like a 2-minute discussion. How about a nude shot? And of course, I was like, "This is great. I'm coming right up."
Let me get Josh from Rowan University to join us on Radio Times. And Josh, looks like go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I actually just wanted to comment on that same image you just mentioned. And I was wondering if there's ever, if you ever felt like you were in danger while you're alone with like a strange person, maybe in a room, and he happens to be naked.
Go ahead, Zoe.
That's an excellent, excellent question. And the answer is actually no. I mean, if I was ever uncomfortable, I would not be there. If I ever felt discomfort or I ever felt that, even if I felt a bad vibe at all, I would have no interest in having that kind of exchange. And with this man, and I'm not saying that this is not, in some ways, nuts. To just go into a stranger's apartment and have him say, how about a nude shot, and then pose nude, and then me just leave. But that's a good one, because at no point did I ever feel threatened. The door to his apartment was open. It was really kind of a moment that was really filled with exuberance, and there was never a moment in which it felt like, oh, this is turning a little bit creepy. It was great. It's crazy to say that. It was really positive. And there's never a time that there's never a time where I'm thinking, oh, this is uncomfortable, because then I would just be leaving.
Josh, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me ask you about Flip Mattress. I don't know if that's your most famous photograph, but it's of maybe I'll have you describe it.
Yeah, it's mattress.
It's a wonderful photograph, but have you describe it?
Thank you so much. It's an image of two young men, two boys actually, and one is in the air flipping off of a stack of mattresses, and he's in mid flip, so he's kind of torso down. Torso up. So he's
head down,
and his head is facing the ground, and there's another young man in the background. Looking at the flip, so there's a lot of joy and exuberance in it.
And this was a scene you were driving with somewhere in Philly.
Yeah, I was just coming back from Oregon Avenue. I can't remember why I was there, and I was just driving home to where I'd lived on Wharton Street at the time, and
saw these kids playing.
Yeah, saw these kids doing these insane. I could not believe the skill level of the flipping that was happening off of these mattresses. It was next level.
So you stopped, obviously, and said, can I take your picture?
Yeah, I stopped. I drove around the block. I stopped. I asked if I could make their photo. And I'm usually a little hesitant if there's no adults. I try to not make photos of children, because I want to feel that like everyone is actually aware that the photo's being made and where it can go. And this was a group of kids playing out on the street, and I didn't really have that same kind of feeling of a direct portrait, because it was genuinely a street scene among a number of other people outside.
And there's a sad story to this photograph, and actually Tara Murtha wrote about this in a beautiful piece in the weekly, one of the weeklies in Philadelphia, about one of the boys in this picture, a kid known as Boo.
Yeah, Boo, Lawrence Rose. Tara's piece was very, very beautiful and moving, I thought, and very important in relation to the way that we live our lives in the city, and the kind of connections that we have to people who might be our neighbors and yet we don't necessarily know. And so it's a devastating story with him.
And he's the boy standing watching the other boy flip.
He's the boy standing in the back, and he was shot and murdered a few years ago. And I got in touch, or rather his family got in touch with me, to let me know, and it was a really very difficult and overwhelming overwhelming story to kind of contend with.
And you met with the family.
Yeah, so I met his mother, Dorothea, and his sisters, and his cousin Booty, who's the one flipping, and a lot of the family. And it's I talked with them a lot. That image went up actually on the art museum as one of the billboard components, and I spoke with the family a lot about, you know, how do you feel about this? Does this seem like it's right to you in terms of the way that the image will be read and how people move under it? And so it was a kind of discussion about where the image would go and what the image means, actually. And it came from her finding a friend of Boo's mother, Dorothea, finding the image in an art museum book for children.
In a library.
Yeah, it was pretty beautiful, actually.
And the family felt comfortable with displaying this photo. And I mean, Boo he's enjoying, I mean, he's a young man, and he's laughing and he's looking at his cousin
Yeah.
Doing this flip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the family felt very strongly that it felt like him. It looked like him, and it really felt like him. And one of the things that kind of came out of this discussion was that it was Boo was a thumb sucker, and I never knew that. And the gesture that he had in this photo was one that the whole family knew. And I had always thought he was kind of exclaiming with, "I can't believe this flip." And in truth, the family knew this gesture much, much more intimately, mm-hmm. and they all recognized it and kind of had an immediate reaction. So it was pretty. It's both very painful and also very beautiful. I'm very, very happy to know them.
And that's Zoe Strauss, our guest today on Radio Times. The Philadelphia Museum of Art has an exhibition of her work called Zoe Strauss 10 Years. Also, you can see her work on more than 50 billboards all over the city of Philadelphia. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me see what Holly from Elkins Park has to say. And Holly, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am an artist as well, and I was a photo minor, illustration major, and I'd like to explore your titling your work, because I know that I don't like to title my work. I like the viewer to come to their own narrative, and I know that galleries and museums often push artists to title the work because mm-hmm. they feel that the viewer needs their handheld in trying to come up with understanding the work, and I feel that kind of compromises the viewer to explore their own narrative to the work. And would you please tell me how you supported yourself before you became famous, because that's the biggest struggle for artists these days.
Indeed it is, Holly. Thanks for the call. Yeah, the idea of titling.
Yeah, that's it's such an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking. I was actually just talking about this yesterday. The titles of the images all just came from my own need to identify them. And when they were displayed under I-95, they were displayed without title and just a very brief descriptive text in order so that I knew what the photograph was. And as the work kind of moved forward, some of the titles, which I had used for my own reference, obviously were starting to become the way that the photos were identified. And I wasn't super, super comfortable with that. I wanted these images I wanted there to not be direction for these images. And one of the things that I found is that a few have kind of slipped through the cracks. And one is an image called Alzheimer's. Uh-huh. It's an image that that I made of a woman. And that title is actually completely inaccurate, because the title was coming from my first reaction and not from the interaction. Mm-hmm. But I made it many years ago and never thought that I would be able to, I would need to retitle it for having this massive show, which still seems completely surreal to me. Mm. So it's one of them that kind of moved forward with essentially an inaccurate title. It was a title that was personal just for myself so that I could remember what the image was. And when it was presented essentially without title. So I often think that you do not need a title, and that when you yourself are moving your work in the way that you want to, and you don't want to direct people with the title, then that's absolutely great. It's fully one's own prerogative. And sometimes, in terms of cataloging, it makes it easier for them, but them meaning everyone. And that's a very valid, but yeah, it's kind of a battle. And then the other thing is
about money, making money.
Yeah, oh, money. I know. Christ. I worked as a babysitter up until 2005.
I read that about you.
Yeah, and that was how. And in addition to working as a babysitter, my own wife has supported me. So my wife has a job, and I'm on her health insurance. That's still currently. That's how it goes. And it would be, had I not had financial support from my wife, I would probably still be having to have another job. And after the show, my guess is I'll probably have to teach or possibly figure out a different way to make money. There's not a great answer for that.
And were you a longtime babysitter?
Oh yeah,
from like
15
when you were
years.
As a teenager into adulthood.
Yep, the same kids. They worked out great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love them.
Let me see what Pete from South Philadelphia has to say. Pete, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Joe. Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
Great to be on the air. I just want to comment that I knew Daddy Girl Tattoo. Monique was her name. I grew up in the same block where she, quote-unquote, worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just interesting to see her a few years ago. I've been an admirer of your work for several years, and I saw her photo in one of the papers. And just the memories that came back, and just, you know, how hard this girl had it. You can kind of see it in her face and just in her getup.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just again, she's been deceased now for several years. Unfortunately, she OD'd. She was a addict / prostitute in the neighborhood back then before the neighborhood became gentrified.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing that the memories that she brought back of how the neighborhood was, just a lot of other things other than her, and still seeing some of her, you know, people who paid her in the neighborhood today, still seeing them around. It just brings back memories that, you know, just haven't gone up in a while. And I want to thank you for that as well.
Well, Pete, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
I want to say thank you so much for, thanks so much for calling. I knew Monique too. I met her to make her photo. And then I met her again. And shortly after her death, her mother got in touch with me. She comes from a family who I really love them a great, great deal. And I became very close with her family, but I didn't know Monique except from the neighborhood, except from seeing her around. And the Daddy Tattoo photo, which is also close to my house, and I kind of knew her from around. And it was, you know, the neighborhood was certainly a little bit different right then. And one of the things that I find when I look at her photo is that I have such a strong connection and an unrealistic relationship with her because of how often I look at her photo and how much love I have for her family, who has been really very, very supportive and really engaged in my work. And I can't be any more grateful for what Monique and what her family has given me. Their generosity is kind of unending in relation to how much I want to tell the story about Monique, and that means presenting two very, very difficult and painful images of her. And I'm really grateful for your call.
Pete, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times as well. And we're almost out of time here, Zoe, but it also, I mean, it shows what photographs can do, but it's not the whole story, right? I mean, we're stuck with I don't mean stuck in a bad way, but we have these fixed images, and there's a life there.
Right. Right, and that's absolutely a big part of my work. And as I-95 moved forward, that was one of the big components of it, that it's this fixed image, which is not accurate. It's a two-dimensional image in which there's no context, and you yourself have to bring it to it. And it resonates in different ways with different people, and especially with people kind of who are in the neighborhood near my house. We both know these places literally or figuratively, and so it brings up a lot of stuff. And I'm really grateful for that call, Pete. Thank you.
Yeah, Pete, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Zoe Strauss, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me. I loved being here.
Well, we loved having you here, and you can see her work on billboards all over Philadelphia. Also at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, there's an exhibition, Zoe Strauss, 10 Years, and it runs through April 22nd. Coming up, the Tuskegee Airmen. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital joins you in supporting WHYY. Jefferson Hospital for Neuroscience is dedicated to the care and treatment of patients with aneurysms, acute strokes, AVMs, and brain tumors. Employing the latest in non-invasive technologies, including endovascular coiling, interventional stroke therapies, gamma knife, and shaped beam surgery. To schedule an appointment or for information, 1-800-JEFF-NOW or jeffersonhospital.org.
Did the economic stimulus program amount to a costly failure or save us from a depression? Investigative reporter Michael Graybell scoured records and traveled the country for his new book, Money Well Spent. Hear his assessment of the stimulus program on the next Fresh Air. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. In the intelligence business, they call it a false flag operation. Israeli spies posing as American CIA agents to recruit terrorists to attack Iran. Also, it won a big award for best new map, but it came from a very small company, actually just one guy. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. The Tuskegee Airmen were African-American pilots and navigators, bombardiers, instructors, and support personnel who fought the Nazis in World War II. They also fought discrimination and racism stateside. In fact, their actions in the air and on the ground helped to lead to the integration of the military. George Lucas's film Red Tails is about the Tuskegee Airmen, and it's playing in movie theaters. We asked Major John L. Harrison to join us on Radio Times. He is a member of the Tuskegee Airmen, also a recipient of the Congressional Gold Medal. And Major Harrison, what a pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure.
Are you getting comfortable with all this attention that you've been getting?
Almost too much.
Almost too much for you. Have you seen the film?
Yes, I have.
And what do you think?
I enjoyed the film. I thought it was a nice presentation, covered a lot of different aspects of the problems and different relationships that we encountered during our military careers.
Well, I want to talk about all of that, and let me just go back to the beginning. When did you want to become a pilot?
Well, it started when I was 8 or 9 years old. I grew up in Kansas and Nebraska. And I was out in the field one day, 9 years old. An airplane flew over, and I decided I wanted to be a pilot.
Wow.
And I thought that I could become trained by the Army Air Corps and be a commercial pilot, you know.
Now, you went to West Point.
No, I did not.
Oh, you did not. Oh, I excuse me for that mistake. So how did you train to be a pilot? Where did you get your training?
At Tuskegee. For some reason, I don't know how it happened, but a old magazine made its way to Nebraska, and I got a copy of this magazine. Had pictures of the first 5 black pilots that were trained in 1941, including General Davis. I had this magazine with the pictures of the first 5 pilots. And at age, I guess I was 20, I just passed my 20th birthday. And I went down to the recruiting office in Omaha to volunteer to be trained as a pilot. There was a 6-foot sergeant from Texas, with Texas accent, and he looked at me and said, "What do you want?"
Like that?
Yeah, and I said, "I want to volunteer to be trained as a pilot so I can go shoot down Japs and help win the war." The sergeant was astounded. He didn't know what to say. He looked at me, and he said, "We don't train you people to be pilots." And I said, "Oh, yes, you do." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I have a picture of the first 5 colored pilots that were trained at Tuskegee."
And what did he say to that?
He said, "I don't know anything about that," and he threw me out of the recruiting office.
Wow.
At least he was kind enough to refer to me as "you people" rather than the N-word that they normally used.
So how did you end up? How did you end up then in Tuskegee in Alabama?
Well, I came back several weeks later, and I had this picture of the 5 pilots. And I came into the recruiting office. The same sergeant was there, and he said, "What do you want now?" And I said, Here is the pictures of the 5 pilots." And he said, "Give me that." And he snatched it out of my hand. And there was a door in the recruiting room where we were. and above the door it said Captain. He opened the door and went in. He was in there for about 5 minutes, came back out, the door opened, the captain came out first, and the captain, I was astounded because the captain walked over to me and said, Mr. Harrison, you really want to be a pilot, don't you? And I said, yes, sir, just like you. He was not a pilot, but I thought I'd butter him up a bit. So, to make a long story short, yeah, the captain told the sergeant, have Mr. Harrison fill out those forms. Now, they were in there in that office, captain's office, about, I guess, between 5 and 10 minutes while I was waiting outside. And I'm sure they made telephone calls to our higher headquarters to get clarification as to what the heck was going on. They're actually training black people to be pilots. So I went home, and I received a call, notification to come in and take an intelligence test and a physical. Now, I was working at night at an aircraft plant as a janitor, and I went to work at 11 o'clock at night, got off at 7 o'clock in the morning, and would eat, and then I would go to Omaha University, and I was taking a course in Principles of Basic Aerodynamics. Mm. It had been advertised in the newspaper that this class was available for young men that might want to go into aviation. So I had been taking this class, and it covered just a lot of different aspects of the theory of flight dynamics, and reviewed mathematics and all that. So when I took the intelligence test, because I was in the midst of this program, I aced the test.
I'm actually not surprised to hear that.
Yeah, and because I had been a youngster growing up on a farm, eating fresh food and fresh air and all that, I was physically perfect. So I aced it. Let me tell you a little bit about the intelligence test that you may not know.
Well, you know what? And only because I'm looking at the clock here, and I have so many questions for you. If you don't mind, I am curious, though, about what it was like to train in Tuskegee at Alabama, and you mentioned this Captain Davis. I read that he was a tough taskmaster, but what was the training like when you were down in Alabama?
Excuse me. I would like to add one thing.
Okay.
On the way to Tuskegee, I was taken off the train when the train stopped at St. Louis, and the Mason-Dixon line was at St. Louis. I didn't know that. That was my first brush against discrimination, being taken off the train. Got back on the train, and the all-colored car behind the engine where all the soot and smoke was, and made my way to Tuskegee. Mm. At Tuskegee, I arrived in February and was there until December 5th when I graduated. The course was 10 weeks long, and we had pre-flight, basic, and advanced training.
Right.
And each session was 10 weeks. We had physical education. We had to run a couple of miles every morning, get up at 4:30 in the morning for Reveille. But it was wonderful, and I can remember when my first flight, the instructor got out of the airplane and said, okay, you take it. I don't want to get hurt. So I took off, came around, landed, and that was my first flight.
Yeah.
Because I had not, I don't think I'd even been close to an airplane.
And so what kind of planes did you end up flying?
Well, our first plane was a biplane, two wings. That was our primary trainer, and then we went to the basic 10 weeks, and we had a we call it the Voltaire Vibrator. It was a single engine airplane, and then the Advance 10 weeks after basic, we had a 20-engine airplane. One of the 20-engine airplanes was made out of plywood.
Oh my goodness!
And a plywood body.
Well, you know what's so interesting is that the Tuskegee Airmen that were flying missions over Europe, part of their job was really as an escort, and to stay with the bombers that were doing the bombing in Europe. What do you think explains the success of those flyers, the Tuskegee Airmen?
Well, I think the there were 1,000 of us, 902 that were trained as pilots. And half of us were trained as bomber pilots, and half of us were trained as fighter pilots. Mm. After we graduated, we were assigned on that basis. And the pilots, our single-engine pilots, they flew more than 15,000 sorties, and they destroyed over 1,000 German aircraft. Mm. They received hundreds of air medals, and they were awarded more than 150 flying crosses. So they did a heck of a job. That was the fighter group, 560, I think, 460. And the bomber pilots, which I was one of the bomber pilots, because of discrimination and racial prejudice, we trained for 3.5 years and never got into combat.
Yeah, in fact, you were here stateside. And let me just quickly reintroduce you. Talking with Major John L. Harrison, a Tuskegee Airman, a Congressional Gold Medal recipient. We are talking about his experience as a Tuskegee Airman. And I was reading, Major Harrison, about some of the problems stateside and the treatment of black pilots such as yourself at the Officers Club, and these were clubs obviously open to officers in the military. How were black officers treated?
Well, that was a double sort of a double insult, not being allowed to go in, and then at the same time, our pay each month, a deduction was made for officers club dues. When I arrived at Selfridge Field after my B-25 transition, we went to the officers' club. They wouldn't let us in. Mm-hmm. And we kept coming back. So finally, the commanding general of the 1st Air Force, he said, have all the officers in the base theater next Thursday at 1300 hours. I will be there and talk to them. We went to the theater. They had a rope down the middle. On one side sat the white officers, who were our instructors and like that, and on the other side, all of us black officers. Mm-hmm. I was a brand new second lieutenant, bushy-tailed and ready to fight, and this commanding general got in front of us on the stage, and he spoke, and among the words that he said, you people have not been ready for the past 300 years. You probably won't be ready for another 300 years. You will not use that officers' club.
Wow.
That was a throw, face full of cold water.
I bet.
You know.
But
so,
you know, but interestingly, and this was, of course, after mm-hmm. the war, and I think in many ways because of the accomplishments of the Tuskegee Airmen and people like you, is that the military began to integrate.
I fought my way and scratched my way. I was trained in two schools and assigned to two particular bases for the job that I was trained for. And when I arrived at the base, they put me in the motor vehicle squadron, mm. where all the black troops were. Mm. That happened in California, happened in Hawaii. And I had to write letters to the commanding general, to the base commander, in order to be given a job. I said, I have been trained. I've used taxpayers' money to learn to fly. I'm a pilot. I demand to be assigned as a pilot. And I sort of got a reputation for being
speaking up.
Smarty. And I retired after 23 years in the Air Force with over 10,000 hours command pilot with the highest pilot rating in the Air Force, and I retired as a major. And the reason why I was not a colonel or a brigadier general was because I was too hot-headed, not hot-headed.
I was going to say outspoken?
Outspoken, yes.
Are you? We're almost out of time here, but do you have bitterness at all about this
no,
period of time?
I guess, strangely enough, I think that my Air Force career was wonderful because I ended up having 30 crossings of the Pacific and approximately 30 crossings of the Atlantic. I've flown all the way around the world a number of times. When I was stationed in Hawaii, I flew from Hawaii to Japan, to Hong Kong, to Karachi, to Saudi Arabia, came back to the United States. I would leave to New York, fly New York to Scotland, to Paris, to Madrid, to Cairo, Egypt, to Saudi Arabia, the opposite direction. And I just had a wonderful time, and I flew and was paid for it, and I had a wonderful time in the Air Force.
Well, I thank you so much, and I congratulate you for your service, and I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome.
And I like to talk about airplanes.
Well, and that's why we had you on the show. Also, because you are a Tuskegee Airman, you also received the Congressional Gold Medal, and our guest has been Major John L. Harrison. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.